So you folks know that I think that laughter is holy and healing, and so we're going to start with something funny today. I heard about these three sisters, ages 96, 94, and 92, who all lived together. And the 96-year-old was taking a bath, and she went to put her foot in, and she stopped, and she called to her sisters, "Ladies, was I getting in or coming out of the bath?" And the 94-year-old said, "Ugh," she was downstairs, and she said, "Okay, hold on, I'll come up and help you." And she got halfway up the stairs, and she stopped, and she said, "Was I going up or coming down?" And the 92-year-old, the 96-year-old, who was still the last sister, who was downstairs, 92, said, "Boy, you know, I'm going to go help them." So she thought to herself, "Well, I'm going to go and get up there, and it'll be fine. But man, I really hope that I never get to be that forgetful. Knock on wood." And she said, "All right, I'll come and help you. Just let me see who's at the door." It was still funny, even though I ruined the delivery. Yay. As we said in the announcements, we'll be discussing Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail 2 weeks from now over a potluck meal. And of course, Monday, we celebrate his birthday. Many of us know Dr. King is a great civil rights leader, and we have heard or read his I Have a Dream speech. If we are white, most of what we know about Dr. King is that he fought for equal rights for African Americans, and that he did so peacefully, meaning without guns or fighting. If we are brown, we most likely know much more. One other thing we know, regardless of skin color, is that King's faith is what led him and gave him the strength to move the mountains that he did. Dr. King considered himself first and foremost a preacher. We know this from his speech Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, which was the last speech he delivered before his assassination. He said he was, quote, a preacher by calling. He said, "This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I'm speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communist and capitalist, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them?" And he went on to say, "I must be true to my conviction that I share with all men the calling to be a son of the living God. Beyond the calling of race or nation or creed is this vocation of sonship and brotherhood. And because I believe that the Father is deeply concerned, especially for his suffering and helpless and outcast children, I come tonight to speak for them." Now, it's easy to look back through history on Dr. King and say, "What a peaceful, righteous man. He attacked injustice in a morally unassailable way. What a perfect example for everyone to follow. Of course he won." Well, two things. First of all, he didn't win, right? We know that. Believing that racism is a thing of the past is a lie born to preserve white cultural supremacy. Now, I know this is a bold claim to make, so let me give you two pieces of evidence, one anecdotal and one statistical. I also want to say at this point that I never say anything in my sermons that I can't back up with evidence. So if you ever hear anything and you're like, "Wow, that is incredible," feel free to come up to me afterwards and say, "Where did you find that? I want to read about it." When my husband and I first moved to California, we noticed a shocking absence of black men and women. I mean, there were none. A year into our stay here, I visited the Santa Clara County Jail to explore ministry possibilities. As I stared up at the faces peering out at me from the tiny cement cells with slotted windows, I muttered aloud, "Oh my God, here they are." "What?" asked my companion, the prison chaplain. "I haven't seen this many black folks in one place since I moved to California," I replied. She simply nodded sadly. There's a theory, a compelling one, that the legalized discrimination of Jim Crow has been replaced by the legalized discrimination of mass incarceration, and the statistical evidence does bear this out. Michelle Alexander, in a groundbreaking work, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, which we'll be reading next month, more on that, you can ask me, writes, quote, "The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of nearly every developed country, even surpassing those in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. The racial dimension of mass incarceration is its most striking feature. No other country in the world imprisons so many of its racial or ethnic minorities. The United States, and this blows my mind, the United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. What makes this comparable to the Jim Crow laws of the southern U.S. is that, again from Alexander, quote, once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, denial of educational opportunity, denial of food stamps and other public benefits, and exclusion from jury service are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. So if Dr. King's aim was to eradicate racism or to end its consequences, he was unsuccessful. He brought one form into the light, but like the serpent it is, it found another shadow in which to hide. Second, when we look back at Dr. King, we often forget at the time he was not seen as some universally unifying angel. His actions were deemed controversial, inappropriate, and not just by, you know, the Grand Dragon in Alabama, by ministers, by political figures, even other civil rights leaders didn't like his tactics sometimes. Some said he was too angry. I know that sounds familiar to Black Lives Matter folks, and as a feminist, I hear that all the time. And others said that nonviolence would just never work. The claims leveled against him sound strangely familiar, that black-on-black crime proved that racism wasn't the real problem, that black folks' campaigns for equal rights took time and money away from the real issues. In 1966, 3 years after his I Have a Dream speech, a Gallup poll confirmed that only 33% of Americans had positive feelings for him. We like to think now that if Dr. King had been around today, most Americans would stand behind him, but the reality was different. Most Americans did not. He was not, in his lifetime, the universally loved figurehead we have reduced him to in the years after his death. He made people uncomfortable. He made people angry. He was divisive and even shocking, and a majority of white folks didn't support him at the time. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, I've taken up boxing again. Les, my husband, says I should get a picture of this and then post a picture on the internet saying, social justice warrior. Now, social justice warrior, or SJW, as it's abbreviated online, is a derogatory term used on the internet to refer to people who get upset over racism, sexism, etc., and speak up about it. I've been called that in comments sections and on Reddit and even by my own family members because I can't seem to stop myself from getting upset over that stuff. Les says the meme will help me reclaim the term. Reclaim the term? I said to Les, that term is mine. They can call me that all they want. Heck, I'll get a t-shirt with it in big red letters and wear it every day. I would wear it next weekend at the Women's March on Washington. I have this hat that Susan made me with ears. I'm not going to explain the correlation because this is going out online, but you get it. I'll wear it at the Women's March on Washington. You know why? Because my faith tells me that as a woman living in a society in which I am most likely to be killed or hurt by a man, and most likely one that I know, I need to stand up for my God-given right to dignity, safety, and equality. Perhaps you are going to one of the marches in San Jose or San Francisco. You don't have to be a woman, you just have to care about women's rights and safety. And I can't imagine there's a single person in this room, male or female, who doesn't believe that women should be safe and respected all the time, everywhere. But dual Pulitzer Prize winner Nicholas D. Kristof writes, quote, women worldwide, ages 15 through 44, are more likely to die or be maimed because of male violence than because of cancer, malaria, war, and traffic accidents combined. And the CDC says that spouses are the leading cause of death for pregnant women in the United States. That is not what I or anyone else deserves. When I go to Washington, I'm not going to yell obscenities or hurt anybody, But our president-elect has said some things that make me think that he doesn't believe that I, as a woman, am a child of the Most High God, but I do, and I always will, and this March is the first time I'm saying all that publicly with my mouth and with my feet. But there will probably be press coverage saying that protesters here in San Jose and in San Francisco and in D.C., they're going to say that the protesters are overreacting or that they're shrill or that they're too sensitive. If anyone does anything stupid, like burn something or break a window, heaven forbid, the whole thing will be derided by some as rioting. There will be a lot of insults slung, lots of law-abiding citizens clucking their tongues and saying protesters just need to get jobs. But that's because if you choose to speak up, you're going to offend people. In fact, one of the ways you will know you're saying something worth saying is that the powerful won't like it. If you know anything about the worst kinds of injustice, you know that they are the dark side of the luxuries that we enjoy. For example, according to UCC.org, our website, the National Human Trafficking Resource Center reports that nearly 2 million Americans, mostly women and children, are subjected against their will to forced labor or sexual exploitation. According to the same organization, this human trafficking is fueled by the demand for cheap labor and services for commercial sex acts and is a growing epidemic in the United States and throughout the world. Women and children, especially immigrants, are trafficked illegally, but in part because of that, many of us get cheap produce and can purchase women's bodies for a short time. So therefore, when you speak up, you're speaking up against a system which benefits many, maybe even benefits you. And so there will be those who say, oh, but why do you have to yell? Can't you just write to your congressman? Or why do you have to argue with your aunt? She's old. Let her believe whatever she wants to believe. Why do you have to be so abrasive, so offensive, so angry? Well, as a bumper sticker I love says, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. You have to stand up because that's how change comes. Awareness is the first step towards greater justice. And I know I've stood up here before and said that anger can be toxic. But remember what else I've said, that it's toxic if you misuse it or you deny it. Directing our anger towards systems of oppression is, I would argue, the most appropriate thing we can possibly do with our rage. Now, the systems, not the people. Because another central tenet of King's faith was that every human being is worthy in the eyes of God. We are all brothers and sisters, and therefore, no matter how angry or afraid we may be, we must always treat others with kindness and respect, especially those who do not believe that we deserve the same. As Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. And it is amazing how well that tactic can cause the other guy to just sort of collapse. My younger brother Andrew and I used to get into fights all the time about him coming into my room. He was 18 months younger, and as is the habit of younger brothers everywhere, he didn't mind starting a fight if he meant that he got attention from me. So he said my room was nicer than his. I do have a flair for decorating. It's true. But I always felt so violated when he would just come in. He didn't understand that it was about respect for my boundaries. In fact, the territorial dispute was so important to me that when I was 6 or so, I wrote the word no on my door in brown crayon to keep him out. I wrote it on the inside so he couldn't see it, but the passion was there. I was trying to make my voice heard. Eventually, my dad installed a simple lock on my door so I could lock it when I was inside and Andrew couldn't come in. This didn't stop my brother from trying, of course, and so the fighting continued. For months after the lock was installed, I spent hours arguing with Andrew through the door about why he couldn't come in. I'll be nice, he'd say. No, you won't, I'd reply. I have your stuffed animal, was another tactic. No, you don't leave me alone, I'd yell. You have to let me in, he'd cry, and then we'd insult each other. I tried getting meaner and louder, and that never worked. In fact, it got me in trouble. He might as well have just come in and fought with me for all the good the lock was doing. And then one day, I tried something new. I decided that I was only going to say one thing really nicely, no matter what. So our last door-related exchange went like this. Lauren, let me in! Okay. And then I did nothing. Long pause. Are you coming to let me in? Okay. me in. Okay. Why aren't you letting me in? Okay. The doorknob rattled. Lauren, open the door. Okay. Stop saying okay. Okay. Stop it. There was a long pause, and then the whole door shook as my little brother sent his whole body pounding against it in a fit of tiny rage. Lauren, he yelled. Okay. He went away. We never fought through the door again. I remember the feeling of exhilaration I had as I heard him return to his room for the first time ever. All I had to do, I realized, was refuse to play the game his way. All I had to do was be nice but firm, and he would implode all on his own. Standing up for the oppressed starts with the belief that everyone deserves dignity, and guess where that starts? With you. As we discussed last week, God made us who we are. God equipped and empowered us to live our lives, and we, all of us, deserve safety, kindness, respect. And if you ever encounter someone who says you don't deserve those things, remember that your worth does not come from them or even from the culture around us. It comes from God. If people ask you who told you you were so special, you can say, Jesus. That ought to shut them up. Maybe they think you're crazy, or maybe they don't believe you, but who cares? They're not the givers of your value. God is. And if you feel you get those things, if you feel that people give you safety and respect and a voice, that is fantastic. Now, can you use those gifts, that platform, that social capital, to help others achieve the same? Let your faith motivate you. As Christians, our concern is the oppressed, the silenced, the incarcerated, or raped, or trafficked. They are our responsibility. We are our brothers and sisters' keepers, and if we can help them, then we're blessed to be God's hands in the world. King would never have done what he did if he had believed the lies his country told him about his worth as a person of color. Instead, he saw himself and all people through the eyes of God as worthy, deserving, and precious. And that knowledge, the love of his Creator, is what allowed him to be brave but generous, outrageous but fair, outspoken but full of boundless compassion. And you too can draw on that same source of strength, whether you're marching or giving or just praying for survival. The truth can be heard over the roar of our culture and those who would tell us their rights are more important than ours. The young and the old, the sick, the poor, the abled, and the differently abled, all of us, we are all created in the image of God, and there's nothing that can take that away. So as we celebrate Dr. King's birthday, let's think on that, that we are all equal in the eyes of the holy. And where that equality is not borne out, let us pray for the courage to stand up for those whom God has placed in our care as Christians. For we are worthy, and we are faithful, and we are ready. Amen.